Do you know what the secret is to keep a baby's skin healthy? The secret is a diaper that doesn't leave skin wet. You've heard me talk about Pampers Swaddlers on our podcast many, many times now, and that's because Pampers Swaddlers is the diaper for healthy baby skin. Pampers Swaddlers absorbs wetness better than the leading value brand and provides up to 100% leak-proof skin protection and up to 0% skin irritation. And if you're a fan of Pampers, you've got to check out their new Pampers Free and Gentle Wipes, which clean better than Huggies Natural Care and are 5 times stronger, so they resist tearing during a diaper change. With Free and Gentle, mess meets its match. And if you're like me and you love saving and getting rewarded for something you gotta buy anyway, like diapers, don't forget to download the Pampers Club app today and earn Pampers Cash. You can redeem your Pampers Cash for exclusive Pampers coupon savings and rewards. Try Swaddlers with new Pampers Free and Gentle Wipes for healthy baby skin. For trusted protection, trust Pampers, the number one pediatrician recommended brand.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to ABG, Asian Boss Girl, a podcast for the modern day Asian American woman. My name is Mel.
I'm Helen.
And I'm Janet.
May is Asian American, Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander Month, and this month is very special to us. Every year, we dedicate one episode on the podcast to talk through our cultural heritage, from writing letters to our parents' immigration story, and growing up as Asian Americans.
This year, we thought we would dig a little deeper into topics that we are interested in, but just haven't really taken the time to look more into. We want to answer some questions like, why were the Hoysan people among the first Chinese people to immigrate to the U.S.? There's a time in history when the Taiwanese language was being banned. We want to explore that a bit more. And I don't know if anyone else has heard about Chinese knotting, but that's something that I was curious about, and we're going to talk a little bit more in this episode as well.
Knotting, right?
Knotting, yeah.
Because I think about nodding.
Oh, but knotting. Like, oh my God, I did not even think. Yeah, no. Like with like yarn and different. It's a fine art or it's a craft.
Ooh, so excited to hear all about that. Okay, I will start off today with what I want to share. So I wanted to share more about my heritage as someone who is from the, not me personally, but my family's from the Toisan region of China. So for those of you out there who speak Mandarin, you might know this as Taishanese, or for Cantonese is Toisan, or my language is Hoisan. So Hoisanhua is, I always say it's kind of like Cantonese, but when I was doing some research, there's only about like a third of the people who are Cantonese speaking can actually understand Toisanese. Mm. So that's how distinct the two languages are. They're actually kind of different. Hoisan is in the southeast part of China. So if you want to like place it geographically, it's by Hong Kong and Macau. And I've always been super fascinated by the fact that of all the Chinese immigrants to come to the U.S. in the late 18th century and early 19th century, Hoisan was the first to do it.
Yeah.
And another thing is that like Hoisan people are actually a super like minority within China, and especially amongst the U.S. It's like a minority within a minority group, right? So the fact that we were the first, I was like, why? You know, was it because of fleeting persecution? Was it because they were money hungry? Were they hungry? I don't know. Like, why did they come over here? So that's why I wanted to dig a little bit more into it and, you know, learn about not only my heritage, but also share it with you all as well. Okay, so ladies, I want to ask you, if you dig back into your memory from like world history class, right? Mm-hmm. And this was probably like a blip in all of our history classes, but do you remember why Chinese immigrants came to the U.S. in the first place?
Yes. They came to work on the railroads.
Mm. That is my memory too. Yeah.
Yeah. Ding, ding, ding. Correct. Actually, I would hope most people know that by now, but mainly for the transcontinental railroads, for the silver and gold mines, for fisheries, and also later on for laundromats and restaurants. So when I was kind of digging into this, that was the case for the Hoisan people, that it was mostly the railroads, the gold rush, and also just like pursuit of the American dream and its need for cheap labor. The Hoisan region is actually a super rural community. Like when I went back, hella farmland. It's just like straight up kids playing and then there's an ox.
Oh.
Like super farmland. And they're like best friends, right?
Oh.
So back then, I think there was little economic opportunity. There was also ethnic conflict. And so because of that, a lot of the men
of families, they would like pick up everything and just leave and go to the U.S. to try and, you know, support their families. And even though they were making very little money, it was more than what they were making in China, right? Mm. So for decades, they would just be in America. And sometimes they wouldn't ever come back. And when I was talking to my mom about her grandpa, so my great grandpa, that was the case for him too. So towards the end of the railroad building, he did go over to the U.S. to help. And that's like, we don't know much about his story, which is just kind of crazy.
Mm-hmm. He went by himself and the rest of the family stayed in.
So I think there were immigration laws that barred men from bringing their families or their children over. So he was just there alone. And I think he was sending money back. Mm. And the only thing we know is that after his labor was no longer needed, he opened up some restaurants and some laundromats. And then he moved to like England and Fiji, which sounds nice. But like from then on, like we didn't hear anything about him, which is just kind of crazy.
Yeah. I have two questions actually when you're telling the story. How did your family know he actually moved to England or Fiji? Like, did they actually keep in touch? And then afterwards he's like, I'm done talking.
I think he would like send some like notes back, mail back. But then, yeah, after a while, maybe it was also my mom as like, you know, the granddaughter not being as close to her grandpa and like not really understanding family dynamics. I think it was just like the norm back then, you know, to just completely have a grandpa just be gone or like a dad just like gone for so long. So it makes me think about like all these stories that are so unfinished, are so untold, even amongst my own family, like not knowing what happened.
Yeah.
And I think what's kind of sad is that when for this episode, I asked my mom, I was like, oh, what happened to your grandpa? And she's like, oh, yeah, that's all. And I just shared everything I knew. I was like, oh, why didn't you ever ask grandpa about that? Mm. But my grandpa just passed like not too long ago. She's like, why didn't you ask him? I was like, oh, what do you mean? Why do you ask him? Yeah. So just taking this moment to share, you know, if you do have any grandparents that are still alive, like those stories will, you know, potentially die with them if they were to pass. So make sure to take that time to talk to your grandparents if you do have these like burning questions that you ever wanted to ask them and you assume that your parents know. But I think that was just like the way of life back then.
Yeah.
That you kind of just assume that that's, you know, if they're gone, they're gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've shared a lot on this podcast about how I have such a special relationship with my mom. I also love that I was able to get her on the podcast to share her story so you can all get to know her better as well. Without fail, the one thing that gets me choked up is when I talk about how much my mom has done for our family and how she rarely puts herself first. As a kid, I remember how she would offer to buy me new clothes, but always buy her own stuff at discount. Not only that, she leads our family so well and is a powerhouse that keeps us connected. My mom truly deserves a self-care spa day every day. This Mother's Day, treat your mom in your life with Osea's Mega Moisture Duo. It's a value pack that comes with their Andaria Algae Body Oil and Andaria Collagen Body Lotion. I personally use it still, and it's been saving my dry skin. And on top of that, it smells incredible. I just can't get over the scent. The combo of the citrusy scent of grapefruit, lime, and cypress with mango and mandarin notes just does it for me. It's by far one of my favorite scents. I truly believe that taking care of your body is a moment to practice mindfulness, self-love, and compassion. Treat mom to the everyday spa experience she deserves with clean, vegan skin and body care from Osea. Get 10% off your first order site-wide with code ABG at oseamalibu.com. You get free samples with every order and free shipping on orders over $60. Head to oseamalibu.com and use code ABG for 10% off. You're mentioning how the Toisonese people were the first to come to the U.S. and you said, well, within China, they're also like a small minority. How were they the first one to be notified about coming to America for the opportunities?
Girl, I don't know.
I actually find that super fascinating. Like, what?
Why them?
Yeah. Why them? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, based on, there's such limited research out there, and I did try to like go into like some deep holes, deep dives, but I'm just assuming that because it was just such a rural community and they were, I don't know, maybe they were like targeted of like, cheap labor, and do you want to like make something for your family? And, you know, this idea of like making it big, like that's probably what drew them there.
Yeah.
I'm curious if your family had like family friends, were there like maybe your grandpa was the only one from your family, but did he have other people from the village that also?
I don't know. Yeah. I know these are like the stories that I wish I did know. Like sometimes I do see there was this like old grandpa that was in the LA Chinatown, and we would always go clubbing in Chinatown, and he was always sitting outside one of the bars. I guess he, like, maybe his family owned the bar or something. He would always be, like, sitting at the table. And one day I decided to just talk to him, and he was from my grandpa's village, and he would show me all these, like, photos and stuff. So I was like, and I remember thinking to myself, like, I'm going to bring my grandpa here one day, but maybe not at 2 a.m. because we were only in that area and knew that he was, like, out and about during that time. Yeah. So it was a thought I had, but I don't know. That could have been a good connection for them to have. But I don't know any, like, friends of my great-grandpa, you know, that are still here in the States or even in, like, Fiji or England. Who knows, right? Actually, curious for you ladies. I'm sure we've, like, shared this on the podcast before, but do you remember when was the first time your family immigrated to the U.S. and for what reason?
I think the first people to come, I think, are my mom. Mm. I think my grandpa's sister came first. She immigrated to Hawaii. So it was first Hawaii, then my mom and her siblings came over, and my grandparents stayed in Taiwan. So probably, like, I don't know, 70s, 80s? Mm. Yeah.
That sounds about.
Yeah.
What was the draw again for Hawaii, other than it being Hawaii?
I actually don't remember. Mm. I need to ask my mom this. But I just know my mom came because my aunt was already there.
Okay.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. A lot of times it's like when you have family, they kind of pull you in.
They do. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I know for both sides of my family, it was like my mom, my dad that came over for, like, more opportunity from Taiwan. Mm-hmm. But before they even came, I think my mother said that her father, so my maternal grandfather, did start scoping out the U.S. because he wanted to move the family there. Mm. But just she ended up getting there sooner with, like, a student visa. But they were already starting to plan to come over, mostly for opportunity, mm-hmm, to be able to, yeah.
So right now, my boyfriend Ray is actually watching Warrior.
I love Warrior.
I know. You mentioned, you know, like, how much you like the show. And then the fact that you said that, like, your people were the first to come to, like, kind of the Chinatowns and stuff, it makes me wonder, like, your perspective and your opinion on the show.
I love that show so much. We'll definitely plug it in right now. So they actually debuted on Cinemax, and then they got picked up by Max, HBO Max, and that's when I first saw it. 3 seasons. And now they are, I think, like, Netflix's orphan child is what they call it, because, like, they just picked up the show. So it is now out on Netflix. Definitely take a watch. It is so worth watching. It is from the mind of Bruce Lee. So he, like, wrote these stories out. And then his daughter, Shannon Lee, is the one who is an executive producer of the show. And it's a show that captures the early Chinese settlers, mostly men, pre and also kind of, like, leading up to the Chinese Exclusion Act. Mm. So what I find fascinating about the show is that not only does it capture sort of, like, the expected outside, like, exterior racism towards the Chinese people that immigrated here to the States, but a lot of it is about the internal tension within those Chinatown enclaves, like the gangs that were formed, and, you know, just, it's intense. Like, there's a lot of drama, there's romance, there's, like, interracial stuff too. Like, it's such a good show, and I really hope they get renewed for a second or for a fourth season. But, like, every time I watch it, I do think about my great grandpa. It's like, he was probably one of those people that I'm gonna think is part of a tong, part of a gang that's, like, leading the gang. And maybe that's why he cut ties with the family. I don't know.
Maybe.
Who knows? I don't know. I just make up stories now. But it's a great show. Definitely, definitely watch it.
I am super proud to be Taiwanese American, and it feels like such a huge part of my identity. For those of you who don't know, I spent a chunk of my childhood in Taiwan with my grandparents. Due to these experiences, I feel such a strong connection with the country and always want to be in the know of what's happening. I used to either ask my mom what the latest news was or just look up random entertainment articles, but now I have one place I can go for all my updates, Taiwan Plus. Taiwan Plus is your go-to place for English language news, educational content, and entertainment from Taiwan. They have everything from trending international news, lifestyle content, to cultural excursions. It's all free and readily available for you to enjoy. One of my favorite shows is called The Jenny Show. It's an animation that follows a Taiwanese American girl learning to embrace the charm and quirks of Taipei. It's such a fun way for me to feel like I'm in Taiwan without physically being there. I also share a lot of similarities with Jenny as a Taiwanese girl myself. If you're also looking to visit Taiwan, they have great shows that capture all the great eats and spots you need to hit for your next vacation. Discover a global perspective with a unique Taiwanese touch on their website, mobile app, 24/7 YouTube live stream, and social media channels. Are you ready to expand your horizons with Taiwan Plus? Search for Taiwan Plus and follow them on social media.
Okay, so I do want to mention a few more fun facts about some Toisan people that you might have not known out there.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so Anna Mae Wong, she is the first Asian American to get a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame in the 1960s. She was the lead in the first ever U.S. television show to have an Asian American series lead, The Gallery of Madame Lu Song. Mm. She's also the first Asian American to be minted on a U.S. coin. So her grandparents were immigrants from my family's like hometown, which is crazy.
Are you guys related?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. No. Yeah, somehow distantly, probably.
Maybe. Her father owned a laundromat in L.A. and yeah, just had no idea that she was like Hoysenese. And I think there are a lot of Chinese entertainers, especially Hong Kong entertainers, that come from the Hoysan region. Mm. James Hong, who is a legend, is also now in Kung Fu Panda. He's Hoysenese. The author, Maxine Hong Kingston. Gary Locke, the first Chinese American to become governor. Judy Chu, all names we are familiar with, the first Chinese American woman ever elected to the U.S. And Kim Eng, she's the former GM of the Miami Marlins.
Oh.
She might actually be my auntie because my last name is supposed to be Eng.
Oh.
And not Wu. So, auntie, what's up?
Wait, real quick. You said Judy Chu was elected to the U.S.?
Judy Chu, the first Chinese American woman ever elected to the U.S. Congress.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Yeah. Okay. And then last fun fact that I'm going to share. Hopefully y'all find this interesting out there. I mean, obviously I do, but I hope it's interesting. You all know my love for volleyball, right?
Yes.
Did you know that it was first invented in Massachusetts, which is where I'm from, in 1895? And also Hoysan is the birthplace of volleyball in China.
Like nine man?
Oh.
Yes, nine man, but also volleyball in general. All of China is from the Hoysan region. And wow. Girl is from Boston, girl is Hoysenese, so it's like, it was in my blood of all the sports to play volleyball.
Question, did you know all this stuff when you joined volleyball in high school, did you?
I did not. And I think particularly like the nine-man community. So the origin of that is that these Chinese immigrant men, they brought the sport over from the Hoysan region to the U.S. And a lot of these restaurant workers, you know, they were playing with like just a ball of tape and just like a string for the net. And just, you know, that was their way of building community.
Yeah.
And so the sport of nine man, y'all can look it up, nine people on the court, nine men. But it started in 1938 in Boston and in Rhode Island. So they just started a tournament back then. And like since then, it's been going on and it's been super active. And it's like a large, sprawling, like interconnected, beautiful community. And I was part of that for like 10 plus years of my volleyball life. But yeah, I didn't know the history until later on I learned more about it. And I was like, I don't know. I feel like there's very few things nowadays that tie us so directly to like our past generations and playing the sport. I felt like I was like, this is not just volleyball, but it's like community as well.
Yeah.
You know?
That's cool.
Yeah.
You should make sure your son learns volleyball then.
I probably will, but he's liking soccer right now. He likes to kick balls. That's my little portion to share. Hopefully it was interesting to all of you out there. But yeah, the Hoysan and the Hoysan language is a dying language, so I'm holding on to it as much as I can.
No, I think it's great because I remember this one time we did an old video on YouTube talking about like we're learning each other's languages, and we posted on social, and then everyone's like, oh my god, I'm Hoysanese, I speak Hoysanhua, and they're like, and you were like, all my cousins in the comments. But there's a lot of people I think out there that are also Hoysanese that don't get to like maybe outwardly share their culture as much. I think it's really cool that you're diving into the history of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people assimilated towards Cantonese. Yes. Like anyone who is Hoysanese speaking can basically speak Cantonese, and a lot of people can speak Mandarin as well. So there's definitely like a wave of assimilation that's happening and sort of a dying out of the language, even for my son, right?
I think it's very cool. I mean, to your point, we obviously have listeners who relate and come from that cultural background. So hopefully you learn something from this story and now you feel closer to the sport of volleyball and to understanding maybe like how your family got here and why.
For sure.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Do you know what the secret is to keep a baby's skin healthy? The secret is a diaper that doesn't leave skin wet. You've heard me talk about Pampers Swaddlers on our podcast many, many times now, and that's because Pampers Swaddlers is the diaper for healthy baby skin. Pampers Swaddlers absorbs wetness better than the leading value brand and provides up to 100% leak-proof skin protection and up to 0% skin irritation. And if you're a fan of Pampers, you've got to check out their new Pampers Free and Gentle Wipes, which clean better than Huggies Natural Care and are 5 times stronger, so they resist tearing during a diaper change. With Free and Gentle, mess meets its match. And if you're like me and you love saving and getting rewarded for something you gotta buy anyway, like diapers, don't forget to download the Pampers Club app today and earn Pampers Cash. You can redeem your Pampers Cash for exclusive Pampers coupon savings and rewards. Try Swaddlers with new Pampers Free and Gentle Wipes for healthy baby skin. For trusted protection, trust Pampers, the number one pediatrician recommended brand.
So for my part, I wanted to dive deeper into the Taiwanese language. So I think I've said this so many times on the podcast, but I loved reading Pachinko by Minjin Lee. I think just the historical context played into a narrative just made me really curious about my own, like, the Taiwanese history and how that historical context played into my family's story. I stumbled upon the book by Shauna Yang Ryan, which tells this generational story really similar to Pachinko. And after reading the book, I just felt so connected to my Taiwanese culture, and I learned a lot about the history of the people there. And so what I want to talk about today is about how there's a period of time that the Taiwanese language was banned actually from the schools, and you couldn't speak it without getting punished. Just some historical facts that I'll try my best to recount. I'm not sure the year exactly because this is the stuff I'm not the best at remembering, but pretty much after the Chinese Civil War, when Chiang Kai-shek lost to Mao Zedong, to the Communist Party, his pro-democracy party was then kicked out of China and they fled to Taiwan. And when they landed in Taiwan, they pretty much kind of took over the government and everything. But the thing is, at the time, there's also people already living in Taiwan, that people that had been living in Taiwan for generations and spoke the language of Taiwanese. I think during that time was very tumultuous, especially there's a lot of tension with the native Taiwanese people and the KMT party, mostly the government, the military. And there was a period of martial law that happened because I think, again, for with the tension of the political party and the native Taiwanese people, there was pushback because they're like, you're taking over our land, you're taking over our government. And so a lot of the scholars and the scholars and poets and stuff would start releasing articles or saying things. And I think the KMT party wasn't really happy with that because they're like, they're saying you're pretty much promoting propaganda against our government and stuff. And I'm assuming that all the things that were released through the scholars and the artists were in Taiwanese. And so they banned the language and they banned the language in a lot of the public schools. In the schools, they said you could only speak Mandarin. This is our main language. This is the language you're going to be speaking now. The students would be fined if they actually spoke Taiwanese or a little bit came out. So I was really curious because I was like, oh man, I wonder if my mom actually went through this period. So I called my mom. I was like, do you remember ever getting in trouble for speaking Taiwanese in elementary school? Because in my household, we mostly speak Taiwanese with Mandarin being our second language. And she was like, yeah, I didn't get punished, but people in my classroom would get punished. And I was like, oh my gosh, what was it like? She was like, you know, if it slip out, you would then your teacher would call you out and they'd bring a fee or fine the next morning. Just to pay the fine. She also said during that time it was, you know, I think the schooling back then, they were definitely more strict. Like, yes, there's the Taiwanese fine of speaking the language. But back then in schools, if you didn't get a good grade, you'll get spanked. It was the punishment was a little bit different. So I think for her, she wasn't thinking it was a huge deal. She was more like, oh, it's just another, another thing that happens as a punishment in school. But she said when they were back at home, they could speak Taiwanese. And so I think reading this part in the book and digging deeper into history, I was like, oh wow, I didn't realize how important this language is. Obviously, being Taiwanese American, when I go back to Taiwan, I do hear Taiwanese a lot, especially by the older generation when you're going to the markets and stuff. And it just feels really familiar to me because I was raised by my grandparents and they spoke Taiwanese and I spent a lot of time with their friends. And I think hearing the fact that it could have been, I don't want to say it's an endangered language, but it could have been stripped away from our family's history. And I was like, oh shoot, I want to hold on to as much as I can. So whether it's being surrounded by it, hearing my parents speak it at home or just going to Taiwan and hearing it for me, it always brings a little bit of joy to my ears. I actually remember I was at a Japanese market a week ago and I usually hear Mandarin, I'll hear Mandarin. But then I heard Taiwanese be spoken. I was and I went up to the lady. I was in my broken Mandarin. I said to her, I love when I when I said her, I said, when you speak Taiwanese, it sounds so good to me. I love hearing you speak. Mm-hmm. Definitely broken as F when I was telling her in Chinese. Yeah. But she was like, oh, yeah, you can speak Taiwanese. And I spoke a little bit to her. And she was like, oh, that's so nice.
Yeah. Wait, what did you say?
I said in Mandarin. So I don't know how to say it. But in Mandarin, I said to her, 你讲台语我觉得很好听, which is not very like the best way to say.
How similar or different are the two languages?
They're actually quite different. Let me think of a saying.
Like, can someone who only speaks Mandarin be able to understand Taiwanese?
No, but you can recognize, because I understand Mandarin, but I don't understand Taiwanese, but I will recognize the tonation.
That you know, like, it's Taiwanese.
I know it's Taiwanese, but I won't know what they're saying.
You just know that it's Taiwanese, but you don't understand any of the words.
The content of,
oh, wow. So it's completely different.
It is. Like, okay.
Like, how do you say, let's go eat?
I say it really quickly. So Mandarin is 吃饭.
Okay.
Taiwanese is 家灯.
Okay, very different.
Or like,
say like, I need a pee.
Oh, I can't. I know to say, I need to go to the restroom.
Yeah.
So I need to go to the restroom in Mandarin.
That's a little more classy, yeah.
It's mostly because I can't say pee in Taiwanese. But in saying I want to go to the bathroom in Mandarin is a wild treatment. Oh, sorry. I want to go to the bathroom in Mandarin is 我要去厕所, right? Sorry, I have a very strong American accent. In Taiwanese is 我要去厕所.
Oh.
So it's like a little bit.
Okay, a little bit. Okay,
it's a little bit different.
I wanted to hear, like, what are some phrases that are, like, from your childhood? Either that you heard your grandparents say a lot or...
Oh, yeah. I actually love this question. So two things I heard a lot is when I would go visit my great-grandparents, my atzol, that's how you say in Taiwanese, in the countryside, they always say, Melody, go tell them dinner's ready. Mm. There's definitely, like, I couldn't really communicate with them that well, but I'd be like, atzol, japung, and I'll do this, like, to signify eating. Because they're also really old. I'd be like, japung, and they're like, oh, okay. Mm. So japung is something I always, like, said a lot. Because I think it's sifan, or, like, time to eat, like, sifan. It's just a common thing you say so much in the Asian culture. Another thing I remember is good morning. Because I would go in the mornings with my grandpa and my grandma. We'd walk around like the markets to pick up like groceries or just like saying hi to the neighbors. It's galta. I think it's how you say it, galta. And I was like, raising, So I was like, as a kid, I just remember like hand in hand going with them. So those are two, like, I guess like sayings that kind of just bring back memories for me. I asked my mom, I was like, is there a reason why you still speak Taiwanese in our household? You know, because she immigrated here. Like, I told her, I said, the language could easily be lost between me and my brother's generation. And she just said, like, a very simple answer. She's like, it's my culture. It's my identity. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't. Mm-hmm. It's just part of who we are. Mm-hmm. So she's like, I'm going to speak it. Like, it is what it is kind of thing.
Yeah. Even if they try to change that, like, her dialect in school, it's like, this is the one that you're going to be teaching learning from now on. She's like, okay, well, this is what I know.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And my mom said something else that's kind of interesting. She said she was talking to another, maybe like a Mandarin speaking friend. And she was like, oh, wow. Like, the person said to her, like, she's like, you have no accent with your Mandarin. And my mom's like, huh. She's like, oh, it's because in school, Mandarin was the language I had to be taught. Because I guess in Taiwan, there's a saying with the older generation, there is something called Taiwanese Mandarin. Oh. So when you hear like the native Taiwanese, like elders speak Mandarin, there's a little bit of an accent. So it's called, my mom says it's like Taiwan Zongwen or Taiwan Goyi, which is like Taiwanese Mandarin. Because they say things with a little like, a little twang that's just a little bit different. And so I was like, oh, I didn't recognize that. But I don't know, my mom called it out. I was like, oh, it's true. Like when I hear my grandma's sister speak Mandarin, there is a little bit of a slang or like a, what is it called?
When there's slight accent.
Like an accent. So that's my part I wanted to share. I think nowadays I'm just trying my best to like, whenever in Taiwan, I just sit there in conversation a lot just to soak in what they're saying. And I think fun fact that I've shared multiple times is that I do understand Taiwanese more than I understand Mandarin. A lot more.
And you can speak Taiwanese better than Mandarin.
I can speak Mandarin better, but I understand Taiwanese more.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so interesting.
I know. I think it's because it's my grandparents.
Because usually it's the other way around where it's like you can't speak it, but you can understand it. But you can speak Mandarin, but not understand it as much.
Yeah.
So it's like almost like the opposite.
Yeah. I think it's like if you were to have a whole conversation, I could pick up generally like what the Taiwanese conversation is. But in Mandarin, there's some fancy big words. I'm just like, what does that word mean? Like, I don't get it completely.
I see.
Maybe you're more conversational in Mandarin.
Or I am.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah.
Anyways, that's my story.
Oh, thanks for sharing. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing, though.
Yeah.
I'm curious to hear your story. Chinese knotting.
Yes. Okay. Knotting. So when we were kind of brainstorming for this episode, I've shared on my mini show now that this year for me, I am trying to focus more on play, right? Yeah. Engaging in activities that are purely for enjoyment and not for like productive purposes. And when I think back to growing up, what activities did I enjoy a lot? I was really into arts and crafts. Mm. I think around the generation we were like elementary school, junior high, there was a trend of making like friendship bracelets. Did you ladies?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So we would make, yes. Yeah, we would like braid like the friendship bracelets. And I remember also like growing up, I would, my aunt babysat me and my cousins and my sister a lot. Mm-hmm. And she would do a lot of these like, this like kind of string craft. And I was like, oh, what is that? And it's called Chinese knotting, which is also translates to Zongguo Jie. And I have some photos.
Yay! We're doing a presentation.
I think some people will recognize this too.
If you're not on the YouTubes, make sure to hop on.
Yeah, hop on and take a look. But it's not, I have black and white
photos.
Historic. Super like analog here. But if you've seen these kind of like trinkets around there, it's very popularly associated, I think, with like Chinese culture.
Yes.
They're made from like satin, different cords, and they're basically all these different knots. And my aunt used to like make a whole bunch of these when we were, I'll pass them around.
Yeah, pass them around. Babysit.
And these are a little bit more traditional, and they have, the knots have certain significant meanings. Oh. And they're meant to represent different things you would hang around the house or like maybe on the dashboard on your, or like on the car mirror.
Because we have one.
Yeah, it represents like prosperity or wealth or like good luck. But she would also have fun and like create non like, maybe like,
cultural.
Chinese cultural things. Like she made, this is hard to see, but it's like little shrimp.
Oh, this is actually aunt, photos of your aunt's work.
Yeah, these are all photos of, she had a lot. I messaged her, I texted her. I was like, oh, Ai, like I'm going to be talking about this on the podcast. Can you send me some of your stuff? And I got like 50 photos. Wow. Of just like,
she's like, finally someone's recognizing my work.
Yeah. But she was really talented, and she did like there's like shrimp, and then this is like, I think like goldfish or something. And then roses like in a bouquet. There is like for a while the Pink Panther is really popular, so she would like create little trinkets and then like give it to me and my cousins as like for fun to play around with. And her masterpiece that she did is this like dragon that actually was like up in my grandparents' house still. Wow. Like, you know how you put like different displays, and it's, you Whoa. Can't see it on the black and white, but it's done with like a gold satin cord, and she used like wiring and stuff in it. So
that is so cool.
I was just, it made me think about kind of hobbies that I enjoyed when I was younger and what I was around growing up. And if you also are Chinese American and you had aunts and uncles or, you know, maybe like your parents or your mom was really into doing this, you might recognize some of this art and this craft. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to learn a little bit more about the history of it because, yeah, I saw like, I'm like, oh, she made a dragon, or she would fold like the shrimp. And I didn't understand the significance of it. So, mm-hmm. I have some facts that I would like to share.
Yeah, I would love to learn like the history of like why this was a thing.
Why was this a thing? So Chinese knotting or Zongguo Jie is actually a folk art that ties to Buddhism and Taoism, dating back to the Tang and Song dynasty, 960 to 1279 AD. Mm. Chinese knots are often considered folk art, but they embody fundamental principles of Chinese aesthetics and philosophy. Mm. So it is kind of considered a fine art, and usually you'll see ideals of like symmetry, balance, unity, interconnections. These are all like ideas and philosophies that are very important to certain sects of like Chinese culture. And the knots are usually made from a single cord that are woven into different shapes, each with a symbolic meaning. The shape is often double layered and symmetrical. So you'll see in some of the knots and the different patterns. Common materials that are used are satin, cotton, and parachute cord. And most of these are red as a color is a really big theme, and it's common because it's associated with luck in Chinese culture. Mm-hmm. And you'll see that they're often knotted into like charms with beads, and sometimes there'll be like jade stone that's incorporated, and a lot of tassels as well. Sometimes mm-hmm. you'll see these on like outfits, like historical Chinese outfits as well. Yeah. And the purpose of the knots, they symbolize different meanings. So you'll see knots that symbolize love, longevity, prosperity. They're also used as good luck charms, often to ward off evil. evil spirits. So during Lunar New Year or the Mid-Autumn Festival, you'll see a lot of these patterns around. Mm. And I also have, so these are some like knots that I actually remember like my aunt teaching me when I was little. One is a cross knot. And I guess maybe we can put it up on the screen. But the cross knot is like a knot that there's like a view of what it looks like in the front and then in the back. And it represents friendship. So this is a cute knot if you want to learn to tie it to like give to a friend as like a bracelet or something. I don't know. Cute. and then there's also the double coin knot, which represents prosperity and wealth. So it's like a single cord or single piece of string that you learn to create this shape that is quite symmetrical and has the meaning of prosperity and wealth.
Jay, expect friendship bracelets from you now.
Which knot would you like? Yes, like that from the menu.
The double coin knot.
The double knot. I'll pass this around. There's also a clover leaf knot. And this one, it looks kind of like a clover and a leaf, but it represents good luck and fortune. And then this one is like really complicated, but this is a knot that you'll see that I recognize a lot from my childhood. And this takes a lot longer to knot and to create, but it's the Pong Chong knot, and it represents eternity and unending love.
Dang. Oh, okay. I want that one.
Me too. All right, Jay, make two of these.
Yeah.
I'll get back to you in like a decade. It might take a while.
Wow. You know, it's crazy. So as we were kind of preparing for this episode, you're mentioning how you wanted to talk about this topic. And I was like, oh, and I Googled it myself and I didn't recognize like how familiar Chinese knotting is to me. I was like, oh, wow, I see this everywhere. Like, I have this hanging in my house.
Yeah.
I didn't recognize it. And I was like, oh, wow, this is like just part of the culture.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dang.
I mean, now that you've done like this research, what is something that you didn't know before? Because you did this as like a kid, right? Is there something new that you've learned?
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, just knowing that it is a fine art and folk that had like its roots in certain Buddhist and Taoist ways of thinking and philosophies. There was a huge like functional aspect of it in history. They said that there is archaeological and literary evidence that knots were used in China as a method of keeping records.
Oh.
And that not only for recording information, but also sometimes for exchanging messages before there was like writing, before writing was like a commonplace thing. So I just thought it's like there's something that I thought was really fun, like folding friendship bracelets or creating like, you know, knotting like a little character of like the Pink Panther, actually is rooted in a very like is rooted in a craft and a fine art that had not only like philosophical and symbolic meaning, but also historical functional meaning and as a modes of like carrying messages and stuff
like
that.
It's like Morse code, but back then. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And I think now, I mean, you know, like with like Taylor Swift, there's like the huge like popularity of like friendship bracelets and things like that. And I think craft in general, like there's a lot of people that are into like crocheting now and things like that. Knowing that there is like this historical root within this craft that links back to my culture was really fascinating for me.
Yeah. So. And then Jay, you mentioned like growing up, I think you've always been into art. Like I know you're into like pop
arts and
art
crafts.
Yeah. Would you say like that was the beginning of like that interest?
I mean, whether you want to say it's a beginning or an influence, but like definitely like I grew up around a lot of crafting because that aunt and my grandmother as well, like this is like one type of like, I guess like craft that they would do, but they were always like sewing and making things. And so I guess that is probably a part of like the stuff of like natural hobbies that I would enjoy as well.
Yeah,
is this something that you want to continue like with future generations and actually learn to do, you know, yourself more of?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know that I myself will like get into it as a hobby again, but I think like knowing that there's a significant meaning behind some of these like decorative pieces, like these are items that I would want like in my home in some place or like to be able to like have that as a way to have it as like a form of something for my kids to know about. When they have like, because I know like they go to school and you have to like show and tell some part of your culture, like this would be a thing that I would like tell my kid, like, hey, this is a bit of your historical, like the root of where you come from and some of the meanings behind the crafts.
Thank you for sharing. I didn't know, like I mentioned, like I didn't know this is my house and I know the meaning now.
I think the purpose of today's episode is just to share a little bit more, like deep dive more into topics that we were interested in. And if anything, like my takeaway is just appreciation for so many of the things that we take maybe for granted or that we see often, like I did not know about, you know, the Taiwanese language being something that was restricted in schools. Or I see these shapes in my house too, like all the time. And especially around like Chinese New Year, it's everywhere, right? But seeing it and noting that it does take, there's a person behind it, like doing it, and it is an art and a craft, and there's history behind it. I think that's super cool.
Well, thank you so much for joining us for today's episode. We hope this episode encourages you all to kind of dive deep into your family history. And if you guys already did the digging, please share in the comments some historical fact that you found out and you find really significant to you. We'll love to read about it.
Yeah. We don't want these stories to like die with, you know, with just us or even our like past generations. So make sure to continue sharing the things that are unique to you and special to you and for your family too. And with that, we'll catch you all in the next episode.
Bye.